This is NPR on Health. I'm Joe Neal. Today, I'm joined by health correspondent Allison Aubrey. She reports on a lot of consumer health issues for us. Good morning, Allison.
Hey, Joe. How's it going?
Pretty good. We're going to hear two of Allison's stories that have run recently. The first is on attention deficit disorder and how to cope with it when you go to college. Tell us a little bit more about what we're about to hear, Allison.
All right. Well, we're about to hear the story of Emily Allgaier, who's starting her sophomore year at Pacific Lutheran University, which is in Tacoma, Washington. So I met up with her this summer, actually, as she was preparing for her sophomore year, and talked to her about the time in middle school and high school when she was sort of first facing the reality that she had attention deficit disorder at the time she was diagnosed. And we sort of went through what it took to get her on track.
Lots of us find ourselves a little scattered at moments. Who hasn't spaced out during a meeting or BlackBerried their way through a conference call, only to find out later that they'd missed the one important point? For 19-year-old Emily Allgaier, it's not just the result of too much technology in her life. In school, she recalls the moments a teacher would call on her as she happened to be staring out the window.
Teacher would say, "You understand, Emily?" "Yes, yes, a little bit."
Emily's mother, Betty Overby, says her daughter didn't act out or cause problems. She was shy and creative, and early on made very good grades. But in middle school, things changed.
The first time I remember was in sixth grade when she wrote two beautiful book reports and didn't turn them in, and they were in her backpack. And so she got her first D in sixth grade, and we were just completely stunned and appalled.
The same thing happened in French class. Emily seemed to be learning the language, even enjoying it, but didn't finish assignments. Overby says she herself is very detail-oriented, so her daughter's behavior was a real mystery. Here she had this bright child who just couldn't keep it together academically. Early on, school counselors dismissed the idea that Emily needed special assistance. In ninth grade, when she was finally diagnosed with ADD, medicine did help. Her grades went up, but she stopped taking it because she felt nauseated and lost weight. So Emily needed to find a different way to solve her problems. Her family eventually got help from a group of psychologists who specialize in attention deficit coaching. Kathleen Nadeau heads the group.
I am a believer in doing absolutely everything you can to get your brain to function properly. We are very reactive to our environment, so we need to carefully choose the environment we put ourselves in.
Take, for example, homework. Organizing is everything. Nadeau's partner, Kara Gubick, says she doesn't just preach about the importance of organization, she shows it. With Emily, she sat down with a daybook planner, and in a very visual way, she sketched out how to break big projects down into smaller chunks.
Things that may seem simple to people who don't have ADD, like, we'll just have a binder for each subject out and clear your desk. I mean, when I think back to college, I always cleared off my desk before I started work. I think that's just a natural tendency that most of us have. But for someone with ADD, it may not be an automatic thought.
Emily's now starting her second year at Pacific Lutheran University, and her mom was surprisingly pleased that she finished her freshman year with a 3.4 grade average.
Just speaking to her on Saturday, she said, "I've cleared everything off my desk so that when I need to study, I can go there and there will be no distractions." So she's still processing this kind of information.
The freedom of campus life, as appealing as it is to most college-age students, can turn out to be pretty stressful. And Kathleen Nadeau says stress intensifies the decision-making problems that lots of ADD kids have.
The more stressed and anxious we are, the more we are thinking with our emotional brain instead of our rational brain.
To preempt the stress, Nadeau says she helps her college-bound students come up with plans for exercise, eating well, and setting a realistic class schedule.
I'm much more likely to tell them don't sign up for any classes that start before 11 a.m. rather than go to bed at 11. That's not going to happen.
Talking to Emily yesterday, as she made her way to class, she said she's really trying to use all the advice and see what works best for her. For example, her freshman year, she had another student take notes for her so that she could pay attention in class.
And then I realized later that it was so much easier for me to take the notes instead of having someone take them for me.
Emily's mom says finding her own way is really serving her well.
She really, I think, has very good self-awareness now. And I think that learning strategies makes her feel strong.
And perhaps better prepared to keep distraction at bay. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Allison, you really got my attention at the top of that piece when you said, who hasn't spaced out during a meeting or BlackBerry your way through an important
right. Oh,
appointment?
But, oh,
and were you thinking of me?
Neither you nor I is guilty of this. Absolutely not.
No, never, never. Anyway, first, you talked about ADD in this story, and I think we're more often these days we hear about ADHD. I kind of thought ADD and ADHD were the same things, but are they or are they?
Actually, no, they're not. When you add the H in there, the ADHD, the H stands for hyperactivity. So Emily has attention deficit disorder. She's never been hyperactive or acted out in impulsive ways. And so she has the inattentive type of the disorder. When you add ADHD in, or the hyperactivity point, what you have to see in a child is someone who displays, and I can read right here from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual used to diagnose mental diseases or disorders. And basically, to add the hyperactivity component in, what you want to look for is six or more of the following behaviors that have to be seen over and over again over a period of time. And they're things like fidgeting with your hands, getting up from the seat when you're supposed to be staying in the seat, running or climbing when it's not appropriate, a child who has trouble playing or enjoying leisure activities, and a kid who's sort of always on the go or acts as if they're driven by a motor, someone who talks excessively. So these are some of the telltale signs of hyperactivity.
And Emily didn't have any of those things. She just had ADD.
That's right. These kinds of kids are often described as those who live in their head, basically a daydreamer.
Well, the advice you talked about in the story about how to cope with ADD and how someone going off to college might do better in college, would that apply both to ADD and ADHD?
Absolutely. There's a lot of overlap in all of this, yes.
Coaching. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Is that the most common intervention used in ADD in this situation?
You know, a couple things. I guess in order to get the diagnosis, you'd need to go through testing with a clinical psychologist. So from there, you can push for extra accommodations or help at school. And the diagnosis from a clinical psychologist is sort of the starting point. If you're not getting the help that you need in a school setting, then a couple of things. You would go to a psychiatrist if you were looking to be going on some of the medications that many kids with ADHD go on. If you're looking at more of the behavioral interventions, that's when you might go for coaching. And I should be clear here that both the coaches we heard from in the story are PhD clinical psychologists. So if you're going to go the coaching route, you'd want to look for credentials. You want someone either with a PhD in clinical psychology or somebody who's got is a licensed clinical social worker. So again, you know, if you're looking for medicine, then you would go to a psychiatrist.
Is this kind of coaching just out there everywhere, or is it hard to get?
I think increasingly, you know, clinical psychologists have always worked on the behavioral intervention side. And I think that...
So it's not someone... There aren't specific people who are ADD coaches. It's just you would go to a clinical psychologist or a licensed social worker.
That's right. And these people just happen to specialize in behavioral interventions for ADD. Yeah.
I see. You talked a little bit in the piece about strategies for coping, classes after 11 o'clock or someone else taking notes. What are some of the other things that students can do?
Well, there's a whole list on our website, npr.org. Kathleen Nadeau, who's you just heard from in the story, she wants people to make a connection between cognition and nutrition. She, obviously, when people go off to college and lose the scaffolding of home, they lose that scheduled, you know, meal plan where you're eating lunch at school, your parents maybe serving you dinner. Obviously, on campus, it's up to you when to eat. And she really hits hard the point of eating protein at every meal simply because it holds you longer, and what better way to distract yourself than if you're hungry. She also hits hard the idea of exercise, and she's got a whole lot of tips about how to structure study time.
Is there much controversy in this area over what to do with these people, or is this sort of a settled issue?
I don't think it's very controversial. I mean, a lot of people would say that the controversy is
controversies in drugs.
Exactly. Yeah. Drugs, I mean, I think the published research, which suggests that about 80% of adolescents who try stimulant medications do get some relief. And by relief, I mean they actually are able to do better in school. With Emily, her mother told me that the side effects were just too strong, and so it wasn't worth it.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Let's go on now to the second story I promised our listeners, and that is about bisphenol A, the plastics chemical that is found in things like food containers and other hard plastics. You went out to a hearing this week. There was a meeting at the Food and Drug Administration.
That's right. And what I learned is that there is a lot of controversy about the draft assessment that the Food and Drug Administration has on the table.
And this draft assessment is to set the standard for how much BPA is allowable. Is that it?
That's right. Assessing whether the standard that's in place now is sufficient.
I see. Okay. Well, then here's the piece you did this week. Let's roll it.
At a public meeting yesterday, the Food and Drug Administration made its case to a panel of scientific advisors. Michelle Tarowski, a staff toxicologist at the FDA, presented a PowerPoint on how her team assessed the risks of BPA using the best available animal studies, and she summed up the agency's thinking.
In conclusion, FDA has considered the available data and determined that the margin of safety for bisphenol A exposure in all populations is adequate, and the continued use of bisphenol A in the manufacture of food contact substance is concluded to be safe.
But during the next 2 hours of the hearing, the panel heard from members of the public and outside scientists who take issue with this conclusion. Diana Zuckerman heads an advocacy group called the National Research Center for Women and Families. She criticized the FDA for including so few studies in its assessment. She argued that relying on industry-funded animal studies is not a comprehensive approach.
Since these food containers are not proven safe, the FDA should not be assuring us that they are safe. It does feel like there's been a rush to judgment by the FDA, and that does none of us any good.
One of the studies not included in the FDA review is published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It comes from researchers in Great Britain. They studied about 1,400 adults, the largest human study to date of BPA. And they found that people who had the highest levels of BPA in their urine were more than twice as likely to have developed diabetes and heart disease. This is compared to those who had the lowest levels of BPA in their urine. This study finds an association between these diseases and BPA, but it does not prove a cause and effect. Environmentalist John Peterson Myers wrote an editorial on the study that was also published in the medical journal. He spoke at the hearing yesterday.
It is very clear that the FDA cannot conclude with certainty that BPA is safe. That option is no longer open to you, given these new data.
Concerns about BPA have grown in recent years largely on the basis of animal studies. Some have shown that the chemical, even at low doses, can harm fetuses and offspring of mice and rats. Other studies, including some financed by the chemical industry, find no cause for alarm. Stephen Henschies heads the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group of the American Chemistry Council. He says he trusts the FDA's assessment.
We actually think the FDA draft report is quite comprehensive. It's quite thorough. It included assessments from international bodies who have reviewed the scientific literature comprehensively.
The panel of FDA advisors now has 6 weeks to review the agency's assessment and weigh in on whether they agree that the continued use of BPA in food containers is safe. Alice Nalbury, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, so we'll hear more on this at the end of October. But in the meantime, Allison, what should people be doing if they're concerned about BPA?
Well, a couple of points here. If you're concerned about exposure, keep in mind that the most substantial exposure you're likely to get is through these food containers. As we've mentioned, the National Toxicology Panel recommends not microwaving food in these plastics because the chemical can leach. And
is that because the microwave activates the chemical and releases, or is it just because
the
food gets hot and it gets into
the container gets hot, yeah. Is the thought, right? Yeah. The degree of leaching really depends on the temperature. Also in dishwasher, same thing there. You've got a combination of harsh detergents and the heat, and when there's this repeated exposure to the harsh detergent and to the heat, you get a deterioration of the plastic and a release of the BPA.
Is this all plastics? I mean, is it every plastic food container I might put in the dishwasher? Or?
Well, actually, it's all polycarbonate plastic. So it's basically the compound that's used to make plastics hard. Now, here's where it gets squishy. Because BPA is not labeled in any way, we really don't know exactly where you're going to find traces of it and where you will not find traces of it.
So the label on the bottom of a plastic container doesn't say anything about BPA being in it or not, is what you're saying.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. And so in some cases, because of this concern, industry has gone ahead and moved out ahead of any kind of regulation and said, look, we're going to stop using this. Nalgene is a perfect example. People often associate those heavy-duty, durable plastic bottles.
Runners use and bicyclists.
Exactly.
And that you can, sports.
That's right. You pick up at REI that are very common. And that company has gone ahead and taken BPA out of its plastic bottles. Also, you're starting to see at all the big major retailers from Toys R Us to Walmart that they're now labeling baby products, BPA-free, particularly baby bottles.
Hmm. I've read somewhere where I could look on the bottom of a bottle or plastic, and the number 7 is the one that has BPA in it. So the others are safe, right?
Well, I think that's been the rule of thumb, that we know that the number 7s have been manufactured with this, polycarbonate plastic. So I guess the assumption would be that the others don't have any BPA, and I don't think that you can necessarily assume that. There's 7 billion pounds of this stuff manufactured each year, and it's widely used in these common household products.
Yeah, it's not just in these bottles. At one point, it was in a lot of hospital plastics, though. I think it's been taken out.
That's right. But right now, in the epoxy lining of cans.
Tin cans,
so soft drink cans, baby formula, if you're buying canned beans, canned tomatoes, canned fruit.
I said tin cans, but when you said soda cans, so it's any can. Right.
I think there are a lot of applications for this and probably bears further reporting.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's something we'll be revisiting very soon. But I want to go back to the study just a little bit before we end and ask you a question. If BPA is related to higher rates of heart disease and diabetes, does that suggest that BPA might be part of the obesity epidemic?
I think it's too early to say that, way too early, given that we've just now have this one epidemiological study looking at these 1,400 people. What I will say is that for those who've been looking at what they call connecting the dots between the animal research we have and what we now are beginning to see perhaps in people, what animal studies have shown is that BPA works in the body like estrogen. So BPA and estrogen have the same effect on the cells in the body that make insulin. So estrogen and BPA can stimulate insulin production and glucose production and ultimately possibly make people resistant to glucose, which is a precursor to insulin resistance and diabetes. So that's a lot of ifs and a long, sort of line of effect there. But in animal studies, it's been shown that, that the body takes in BPA, mimics or mistakes BPA for estrogen. So in as much as that would be a possible mechanism, that's what researchers have sort of thrown out as a possible mechanism to an increased risk of diabetes. But of course, this is really preliminary. It would be way too early to say that this helps explain something that's this phenomenon that obviously is, obesity is probably a multi-causal phenomenon based on largely on people's behaviors and actions. And
not necessarily just a single chemical, but ubiquitous though it may be.
Very unlikely that it's just a single chemical, yes.
Right. You talk to a lot of industry people out at the FDA. How do they view this new study?
I think what's clear is that this study has silenced those who've been saying all along, we don't have to be worried. I think what it does is it doesn't answer any questions. It just asks more questions.
Great. Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week. You can hear more health stories by tuning into your local NPR station. There's a list of them at our website, npr.org. While you're there, check out more health stories by clicking on the button on the left side of the page. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.